there was no authorization for that comment about my conducting group therapy, but it does remind me of a amusing incident. Some time ago, I was teaching at USC a course, a seminar course on the philosophical foundations of the biological and psychological sciences, and I persuaded the university to permit me to hold classes in my office. And this was several years ago, and one day I walked into the office and there I saw the seminar group sitting around in a circle, much like my own group, and I sat down in a therapy chair and began class by saying, "Well, and how are we all feeling?" Then I realized it was the wrong day and the wrong job. Quite a number of months ago, I was invited to speak at this conference, and I rather quickly agreed to, and then several months later, confronted the thought, what would I talk about? I began to think about how it might have come about that a libertarian group chose to sponsor a conference dealing with the subject of victimless crime. And the more I thought about the idea, the more I liked it. The more intelligence it struck me as having. Because I think there's a great deal of logic in specifically the libertarian group choosing to explore such an issue, and that's really what I want to talk about today. Now, I have two versions of my little talk. Both will be short, but one is two sentences long, and the other is a few minutes long. So I'm going to give you the two-sentence version of my entire lecture now, and then I'll elaborate it. I was sitting yesterday having lunch with Dr. Al Ross, who you heard speak, and Dr. Thomas Dawes, who you heard speak, and we were discussing what we would talk about. Thoughts which lecturers sometimes have 5 minutes before they're to go on. And Dr. Ross told us what he was going to talk about, and Dr. Zaz said, "Well, I'm still thinking," and then he began to sketch out briefly what he was going to talk about, and I said, "Well, I don't know if I have a lecture. I think I have a sentence." So I said, "I will give you, gentlemen, the unexpurgated version of the sentence, and between today and tomorrow, I will think over how to clean it up and make it acceptable for a public lecture." When I told them my sentence, they were both so enthusiastic, they urged me not to change a word or to abridge a word, and to live dangerously, and to tell you the straight version of my thought on the relationship between libertarianism and victimless crime. So when a professor of psychology and a professor of psychiatry in turn urge me on, of course they're no longer here, urge me on to give you direct access to my subconscious mental processes without any intervening censorship, this is the result that you are about to receive. In the past decade or so, five important issues have arisen, at the very least, of wide-scale publicity, all profoundly relevant to libertarianism. Vietnam, the draft, racism, women's liberation, and victimless crimes. The libertarians lost the boat on Vietnam and let the left run away with it. They lost the boat on racism, and they let the left run away with it. They missed on the draft and let the left make that a major issue, and the same with women's lib. Ladies and gentlemen, do not fuck up this time. You know, among libertarians, there are a diversity of different subpositions, some of them very important. Far be it from me to minimize the issues over which libertarians dispute. Some of those differences I take very seriously indeed. But I think that if libertarianism means anything coherent on which we can agree, it is one or two profoundly radical and profoundly important ideas that are wider than political ideas. They are moral and political ideas. Most simply expressed as follows. If someone uninitiated were to ask me, what is libertarianism all about? I would say, first and foremost, libertarianism is a moral political position primarily concerned with the rights of the individual, with the freedom of the individual, and it holds as its primary, most central tenet that it is morally wrong and should be politically forbidden for one individual or any group to initiate force or violence against others. I think that is the central and most radical idea of libertarianism, the opposition to the initiation of physical force. I hope that we can agree on that much. Now, that is a very difficult idea for most people to understand because in our culture and in all the societies of the world, the permissibility of some groups forcing their ideas and wishes on others is so much taken for granted that most people don't think of contesting it. They only think of which ideas should be enforced on whom. Now, what is a victimless crime? It is something that the government calls a crime when an individual does or takes an act which in no way infringes the rights of any other human being. The essence of a victimless crime is that an act is called a crime, yet it is an act which does not involve a violation of the rights of anyone else, does not involve coercion against anyone else, nor any such derivative of the notion of coercion as fraud or misrepresentation. It is an act in which no one's rights are violated, but which the government says you cannot do anyway. That makes it a victimless crime. Now, if the essence of the libertarian position is, with regard to crime, that the concept of crime can only be justified, can only make sense, can only be morally justified in the context of force, of forcing another human being, of violating his rights, of infringing his freedom, then we realize, of course, that the notion of a victimless crime is, of course, a contradiction in terms. And as I believe Dr. Zoss pointed out in his talk, in victimless crimes, there are victims. The victim is the person who is falsely accused of a crime. Now, when I made my rather inelegant opening shot about not missing the boat on victimless crimes, I was trying to really get across this idea. One issue that is as of concern to us as libertarians is how to communicate to people who do not already agree with this, what we are all about, what we stand for, what we are fighting for, what we are wanting. And when certain issues come to our attention, issues that are inherently deserving of our intention, pardon me, inherently deserving of our attention, such as the draft or Vietnam or the other issues I referred to. They're inherently deserving of our attention because they are wrong, because very important moral political issues are involved to which we should address ourselves. We can at the same time be aware that there is a second, if you wish, strategic reason for introducing the world to our position on those problems. because they represent great opportunities to clarify and express and expound what libertarianism is all about. What I like about all the issues I named is that they cut across all standard conventional political classifications. One of the most interesting political developments of the last decade is the fact that we all find ourselves with the strangest bedfellows on the strangest issues. But I think that itself is a very, very interesting opportunity, because when you get people to understand that sexual practices between consenting adults are none of the government's business, and you get people to understand why sexual practices between consenting adults is none of the government's business, it is one way of helping to illuminate why economic practices between consenting adults is also not the government's issue, because the identical principles are involved. One of the greatest compliments which I appreciate and have heard when I have gone on shows sometimes to talk about libertarianism is that I always surprise the interviewer. He says, you know, I've had, quote, conservatives, which I am not, of course, on the show. You don't talk like conservatives, which, of course, for me is a pretty serious compliment. You see, it's very relevant in this context because people think in stereotypes. They think in ruts. They think they know what this position is and what that position is. And it's always interesting when one can do an unexpected twist, because if you can integrate something that the person never thought of integrating, you perhaps open his mind and educate him to reconsider or to look at a new way, look in a new way at what social morality and political issues are all about. Such as that little, you want to call it, trick I pulled about consenting adults. You see, selling marijuana, homosexual practices, or heterosexual oral sex, whatever your inclinations may be, and selling any other commodity at the best price that you can obtain for it, in terms of your freedom to do these things, is not three or four or five different issues. Of course, it's one issue. And when we are engaged in decriminalizing marijuana or opposing laws which tell people what they may or may not do sexually, or when we are pointing out the evil of racial discrimination, it is very important to integrate in our own mind and to integrate in the way we explain to others what we are talking about. Let me pause only for a moment as an aside on racism. Racism is biological collectivism. That's the essence of what racism is. This was an issue that individualists should have been the first to scream their bloody heads off about. And I'm not talking merely about the political aspects. I'm talking about the private aspects. Not everything that's wrong in our society is a political issue. But it would have been the most marvelous thing, aside from being morally right, if alleged individualists and libertarians had been in the forefront of the battle to say, hey, if we are not collectivists, we are not racial collectivists either, and point out the full implications of that. The same thing applies, of course, to the valid aspects of the fight for women's liberation. I say the valid aspects because there are some very irrational statist aspects involved in terms of demanding free daycare centers and a great many other things which somebody else has to pay for. But the valid aspects, equal pay for equal work and so on and so forth. So So often people raise the question, what are the issues that would be useful or important for libertarians to address themselves to?
Well, before we can answer that, we have to be, our mind has to be in the place where we can see where the basic issues of concern to us are crucially involved. Do we see the battle of individualism versus collectivism when it isn't in crudely obvious terms, when it comes in a subtler form, as in racism? Or do we see the issue of no one forcing his ideas on another when it comes in the very fancy form of treating certain types of mental problems, if they are problems, in effect as a crime, in the sense that you get locked up and you can't get out, which is a pretty good practical measure of whether the government regards it as a crime or not. So that when we become aware, for example, of the immense problem about which Zaz has written and spoken so eloquently, the whole problem of involuntary commitment. Now, I'm sure that many libertarians would hear about that and for a long time never connect. Hey, what has that got to do with my social, moral, political interests? But it's got a great deal to do with it. And I think by now that's become very obvious to this audience. So it is an issue of knowing what are the issues that are relevant to the fight for libertarianism, and knowing that socially there is not two issues, there is not six issues in the world, now I'm talking socially politically, there is, to repeat, only one basic political question, fundamental. The rest is implementations, which are important, but not on the same level of fundamentality. And that is the issue of, in a society, is it permissible or is it not permissible for an individual or a group to initiate force against others? That covers everything. Because if that issue is clear, you don't get lost in fighting over, well, okay, marijuana should be decriminalized, but the government has to supervise heroin. You don't get lost in inconsistencies and in details. And the other side of that coin is that every time, if you are choosing, for example, to fight for the decriminalization of marijuana, or you are choosing to fight on the arena of racism, or you are choosing to engage yourself in any aspect of what I will call the valid aspects of women's liberation, your eye is always on the ball. And the ball is to make your listeners aware that the principle involved is the one we have just talked about. Individualism, the rights of the individual, the evil of coercing individuals who have coerced no one. So that whichever fight you are engaged in at any given time, you are educating people to a new way of thinking about human relationships. Because whether you are involved in teaching or in more direct political activities, it's still education. After all, why was the Libertarian Party formed? Now, some of you perhaps were glad that it was formed, some of you thought it was not a good idea. I don't even care to enter into that debate for the moment, because my point is, the Libertarian Party was formed primarily as an educational strategy, to the best of my understanding. Nobody thought that they were going to elect the next president. So what could they have thought? We will do something to make the country more aware of what libertarianism is. As such, that's an educational move, even though the form is political. So if the first and the primary job of libertarians is to make the question, what is libertarianism, be asked less often, we have to be clear upon what is libertarianism in its most fundamental sense, and living in a given society at a given time when certain problems are pressing toward a climax, to hook into problems that are both, to repeat, inherently deserving of attention and can illuminate the wider moral political issue that concerns us, namely the issue of individualism. And it's from that point of view that when I began to think over a libertarian conference on victimless crimes, the more I thought it was an inspired idea. And I really want to congratulate the organizers for that reason. I said at the outset, and I'll say now again in the conclusion, that I didn't plan a long lecture today, chiefly because I really would enjoy most a more informal give and take with you. I wanted to offer this idea for your consideration in the hope that it might perhaps serve a focusing function in making us more aware of the interconnection of these issues and the importance of grabbing this issue and running with it. Don't let this become another new left issue a year from now. That would be a tragedy. Thank you very much. I have the uncomfortable feeling that in my intense concentration on the subject, I might have sounded a bit chastising or bad-tempered. If I did, I apologize. No such intention was in my mind, but that's the way I sounded a little bit to myself. Yes?
You already mentioned, Dr. Brennan, that the five questions you brought up may not be the only ones. You peripherally alluded to homosexual acts. I'm wondering, though, in regard to the question of gay liberation and this whole phenomenon also, you still think that this is one, the first part of a question may answer the whole thing. You still think the time you did a year ago that homosexuals are sick?
That's not a good summary of what I said a year ago. I still take the stand I took a year ago, but that isn't the summary of it. The position I took a year ago is that in a political conference, you would be missing the whole point to argue that homosexuality is or is not as psychologically healthy an alternative as any other, because the primary political point is that even if homosexuality were, it's your word, sick, citizens do not owe it to the government to be healthy. But the primary political issue is an individual's freedom to do his own thing. And if he's on a wrong track, that is his choice and his responsibility. In a political context, I think it is a diversion and a confusion which is harmful to enter into a psychological debate as to whether or not homosexuality is an entirely healthy, viable second or third way. Because the political point is, what business is it of the state, one way or the other? That's our concern here today. Don't you see, look, you would weaken your case. You would weaken your case. If this is a libertarian conference, if you want to have a psychological conference on sexuality, I'd be ecstatic to be invited and to talk on these subjects. But you weaken your case if you're saying, look, we shouldn't have laws forbidding homosexuality because homosexuality, psychologically, it's even better maybe than heterosexuality. That misses the point politically.
I agree with you, but that wasn't why I asked the question. I told you it was a two-part question. I feel, and a great many of us in gay liberation feel, that just as a precedent the state is to all people, your particular profession, given a few exceptions, are just as coercive and are just as a precedent to our brothers and sisters. And I think that is a libertarian question.
Oh, I see. Well, now, I think I have a clear idea of what perhaps you're after. I'm not certain I do. I may have to ask you for further clarification. Very few of the colleagues that I know personally think of homosexuality as being sick. My own view is, as I stated last year, that by the best of my understanding so far and on the basis of the people I've worked with, I do regard it as a problem of development. I do regard it as, in effect, a failure of a certain kind of psychosexual maturation. But if someone comes to me and tells me that he is a homosexual and tells me that he wants to work with me, he has to fight with me to get me to... He has to take full responsibility for deciding that he really wants to see if he can become heterosexual. I never take the position, oh, you're homosexual, let's do something. If I am a very difficult cuss on that subject. In other words, I almost reach to play the devil's advocate in as strongly as I can, such that it's not to take away any implication that your self-evident obligation is to work to change your sexual preferences. And in fact, I have gone so far that in one or two cases, people have got quite annoyed at me because whether it represents an unsolved problem or it doesn't represent an unsolved problem, what I am so much aware of is the following. Homosexuals are treated so abysmally in our culture, and I'm not talking about politically, I'm not talking about repressive laws, I'm talking about people's attitudes founded on ignorance, that if a homosexual were not neurotic to begin with, being a homosexual in our culture would be very likely to produce in him psychological problems merely because of the various pressures to which he would be subject. Most of you, I will assume, in this audience are heterosexuals. But I want to imagine each one of you, to invite you to imagine that you are the only heterosexual in the room. And that they are all looking at you as though you're a bit strange. Now, that's an exaggeration, but it makes a certain point. So, when you talk about my profession or psychologist or psychiatrist being oppressive, we have to make a certain distinction. In a political or a social context, I think we can agree the primary issue is coercion involved or not? Now, psychologists have no powers of coercion whatsoever. Medical doctors, therefore psychiatrists, do. Psychiatry and psychology stand in quite different places politically in our society. A psychologist cannot force anybody to do anything. Now, I am perfectly sure that there are psychologists who not only consider homosexuality sick, but regard it as somehow a much worse sickness than migraine headaches or peptic ulcer or anxiety, and feel they were put on earth by God to eradicate as many homosexuals as possible, and if not turn them into heterosexuals, then at least make them continent, a view that I do not share. Now, I'm quite sure that they do an awful lot of damage and do an awful lot of guilt producing to a lot of victims who come to them for help. I'm quite opposed to that. I can ask you, and I've tried to give you my reasons, don't confuse me with that position. I think I've said something I hope that will clarify a little bit. Maybe we can bounce on now. Yes?
Mr. Brandon, partway through your lecture, you shifted from the second person plural to the first person plural. I'm talking about libertarianism.
I am informed by the questioner that at some point in the talk I shifted from the second person plural to the first person plural, and I'm asked whether or not this signifies anything significant regarding a shift of mine. Is there ambiguity as to whether or not I'm a libertarian? librarian, if I wasn't one, am I one now? Well, I kind of thought, I don't think that's a lack of modesty, that there was known that I was a libertarian. I kind of thought, I don't think that's a lack of modesty, that there was known that I was a libertarian. From the first time I grasped, I'd like to answer your question a little more than
you may. Huh?
Am I what?
Are you really saved? That's what the man said.
Saved. Saved? Saved. Oh, am I saved or not? Oh, I'm saving myself. I want to say something. Yeah, I'm a libertarian.
Am I a libertarian?
Can I prove it? Yeah. If you could have been here today, in the last half hour, you could have seen. What I wanted to say about libertarianism is the following. I like the word very much, and when I first heard the word, when the word first began being used some years ago, I said, hey, that is a good word to pick up and use, before it became as widely accepted. Some of the people I knew at that time thought the word was too awkward or too unwieldy. And I felt very strongly, no, a word like that is needed. Because it's ridiculous to say, I'm a capitalist. Doesn't mean the opposite of saying I'm a communist. You see, there is no word. Then you're going to say, I'm an advocate of laissez-faire capitalism. That was a big mouthful and objectionable on still another count, which I want to name in a moment. There never has been a single word that I have knowledge of in English to name the basic social position that I identified at the start of my talk today. And the reason why I like it better than capitalism or any word pertaining to capitalism is because capitalism is, A, it's a concept arising in an economic context, though of course it arises, you can say, more broadly in the context of political economy. But in addition to that, although I use the word and quite openly speak of myself as an advocate of capitalism, I never liked that as a primary identification politically, because of the fact that there is legitimately by now a very specific association of the word capitalism with the word business. Now, business is something else I'm very much in favor of. But what was needed, in my opinion, was a political term that didn't have connotations referring to any economic group other than to human beings in general. And that's why I like the word libertarianism very much. And I hope it grows, and I hope it doesn't get utterly diluted and screwed up in meaning, which is a very real danger. Yes, back of the room. That's a very fair question. Let me repeat it so that the group hears it. I'm asked whether or not it might be the case that until recently there were just simply not enough libertarians around to have really jumped in on those early issues. But there was no way to avoid missing the boat, because in the early 1960s, libertarianism was still too new. It's possible that you're right. However, I am aware of the fact that none of the libertarians that I knew either those that I liked or some I didn't like so much were making an issue of that in the terms which I felt was required. And all I can say is that such libertarians as I did meet, and I used to go around the country a lot and lecture much more than I do now, and I had a chance to meet a lot of people. I know that I remember my frustration in one of the early issues that I was talking about for a long time. In fact, when I was going to UCLA in 1950, 51, I was writing inflammatory articles in the Bruin. I was very much opposed to the draft. And it isn't that libertarians would disagree about the issue of the draft, but it just seemed very difficult to get the fire going. Nobody that I knew really seemed to think it was the kind of issue that really should be exploded and fought for publicly. And within a very short time, the left picked it up and did just that. And there was an odd kind of lethargy with regard to any issue that was at all topical. And that was part of what prompted my remarks. I think the whole picture is changing. Changing in a better direction. Yes?
Do you think that part of the problem of the lack of social action by libertarians is that, correcting here, this is not your impression, but executives of the movement has been rather lethargic itself in terms of social application of
liberalism? I'm asked whether or not I think that one reason that libertarianism has been lethargic on social issues might lie in the fact that objectivism, which of course was very important historically in the last decade or so relative to the growth of libertarianism, was lethargic. I would have to say yes, that is my impression. I think that that was one important factor. And the origin of that position, of course, I think, was Ms. Rand, beyond question of doubt, because I remember at NBI how vigorously and how vehemently young people would put out, ask questions about what could be done, and Ms. Rand tended to take the position that of a kind of remoteness from the current social political scene. And perhaps this is understandable, in part at least, by the fact that if Ms. Rand herself was very strongly theoretically inclined, maybe the mind that does one thing well doesn't move in all directions well. That's the nature of human beings, perhaps. And that her own remoteness tended to infect, I think, everyone else. Yes? How to do what? Well, okay, but that is, if I understand your question, isn't that what we're talking about right now? My point there is this. You see, in the present situation, legally, it's recognized that individuals aren't allowed to initiate force against others. The government preserves that right for itself, right? So, practically, it becomes a matter of a problem at present to get people to rethink the question, does anybody have that right? Government or individuals? Now, it cannot be fought as an abstraction. Because battles are not fought over abstractions. They're fought over issues. But whoever chooses to fight the battle intelligently has to understand what are the abstractions involved in an issue so that in the way that he fights the issue concretely, he is at the same time illuminating the principle that is abstractly involved. So that, for example, whether you are opposing the laws on marijuana, or you are opposing the draft, or you are fighting on any particular issue, that may be especially important to you and therefore you choose to concentrate your energies on. I don't say, well, those issues are a waste of time. All we should talk about is the abstract question of the place of force in a moral society, because battles are never won on an abstract level. Therefore, you go after the concrete issues that you care about true enough, but you have to know what is their relationship to the central abstract issues for which you're fighting, so that you are constantly illuminating regardless of what concrete issue you are dealing with. If you permit me to tell you a story, I need a little bit of time, but I think it will be interesting. Strategy, to the best of my understanding. Nobody thought that they were going to elect the next president. So what could they have thought? We will do something to make the country more aware of what libertarianism is. As such, that's an educational move, even though the form is political. So if the first and the primary job of libertarians is to make the question, what is libertarianism, be asked less often, we have to be clear upon what is libertarianism in its most fundamental sense, and living in a given society at a given time, when certain problems are pressing toward a climax, to hook into problems that are both, to repeat, inherently deserving of attention and can illuminate the wider moral political issue that concerns us, namely the issue of individualism. And it's from that point of view that when I began to think over a libertarian conference on victimless crimes, the more I thought it was an inspired idea. And I really want to congratulate the organizers for that reason. I said at the outset, and I'll say now again in the conclusion, that I didn't plan a long lecture today, chiefly because I really would enjoy most a more informal give and take with you. I wanted to offer this idea for your consideration in the hope that it might perhaps serve a focusing function in making us more aware of the interconnection of these issues and the importance of grabbing this issue and running with it. Don't let this become another new left issue a year from now. That would be a tragedy. Thank you very much. I have the uncomfortable feeling that in my intense concentration on the subject, I might have sounded a bit chastising or bad-tempered. If I did, I apologize. No such intention was in my mind, but that's the way I sounded a little bit to myself. Yes?
Your invention, Dr. Brennan, that the five questions you brought up may not be the only one. You peripherally alluded to homosexual acts. I'm wondering, though, in regards to the question of gay liberation and this whole phenomenon also, you still think that simply one, the first part of a question may answer the whole thing. You still think the stand you did a year ago that homosexuals are sick?
That's not a good summary of what I said a year ago. I still take the stand I took a year ago, but that isn't the summary of it. The position I took a year ago is that in a political conference, you would be missing the whole point to argue that homosexuality is or is not as psychologically healthy an alternative as any other, because the primary political point is that even if homosexuality were, it's your word, sick, citizens do not owe it to the government to be healthy. But the primary political issue is an individual's freedom to do his own thing. And if he's on a wrong track, that is his choice and his responsibility. In a political context, I think it is a diversion and a confusion which is harmful to enter into a psychological debate as to whether or not homosexuality is an entirely healthy, viable second or third way. Because the political point is, what business is it of the state, one way or the other? That's our concern here today. Look, you would weaken your case. You would weaken your case. If this is a libertarian conference, if you want to have a psychological conference on sexuality, I'd be ecstatic to be invited and to talk on these subjects. But you weaken your case if you're saying, look, we shouldn't have laws forbidding homosexuality because homosexuality, psychologically, it's even better maybe than heterosexuality. That misses the point politically.
I agree with you, but that wasn't why I asked the question. I told you it was a two-part question. I feel, and a great many of us in gay liberation feel, that just as a precedent, the state is to all people. Your particular profession, given a few exceptions, are just as coercive and are just as a precedent to our brothers and sisters. And I think that that is a libertarian question.
Oh, I see. Well, now, I think I have a clear idea of what perhaps you're after. I'm not certain I do. I may have to ask you for further clarification. Very few of the colleagues that I know personally think of homosexuality as being sick. My own view is, as I stated last year, that by the best of my understanding so far and on the basis of the people I've worked with, I do regard it as a problem of development. I do regard it as, in effect, a failure of a certain kind of psychosexual maturation. But if someone comes to me and tells me that he is a homosexual and tells me that he wants to work with me, he has to fight with me to get me to, he has to take full responsibility for deciding that he really wants to see if he can become heterosexual. I never take the position, oh, you're homosexual, let's do something. If I am a very difficult cuss on that subject. In other words, I almost reach to play the devil's advocate in as strongly as I can, such that it's not to take away any implication that your self-evident obligation is to work to change your sexual preferences. And in fact, I have gone so far that in one or two cases, people have got quite annoyed at me because whether it represents an unsolved problem or it doesn't represent an unsolved problem, what I am so much aware of is the following. Homosexuals are treated so abysmally in our culture, and I'm not talking about politically, I'm not talking about repressive laws, I'm talking about people's attitudes founded on ignorance, that if a homosexual were not neurotic to begin with, being a homosexual in our culture would be very likely to produce in him psychological problems merely because of the various pressures to which he would be subject. Most of you, I will assume, in this audience are heterosexuals, but I want to imagine each one of you, to invite you to imagine that you are the only heterosexual in the room, and that they are all looking at you as though you're a bit strange. Now, that's an exaggeration, but it makes a certain point. So, when you talk about my profession or psychologist or psychiatrist being oppressive, we have to make a certain distinction. In a political or a social context, I think we can agree the primary issue is coercion involved or not? Now, psychologists have no powers of coercion whatsoever. Medical doctors, therefore psychiatrists, do.
Psychiatry and psychology stand in quite different places politically in our society. A psychologist cannot force anybody to do anything. Now, I am perfectly sure that there are psychologists who not only consider homosexuality sick, but regard it as somehow a much worse sickness than migraine headaches or peptic ulcer or anxiety, and feel they were put on earth by God to eradicate as many homosexuals as possible, and if not turn them into heterosexuals, then at least make them continent, a view that I do not share. Now, I'm quite sure that they do an awful lot of damage and do an awful lot of guilt producing to a lot of victims who come to them for help. I'm quite opposed to that. I can ask you, and I've tried to give you my reasons, don't confuse me with that position. I think I've said something I hope that will clarify a little bit. Maybe we can bounce on now. Yes?
Mr. Brannon, partway through your lecture, you shifted from the second person plural to the first person plural while talking about libertarianism. Is there any ambiguity in your mind as to whether you're a libertarian or not? And if you are, where did you become one?
I am informed by the questioner that at some point in the talk, I shifted from the second person plural to the first person plural, and I'm asked whether or not this signifies anything significant regarding a shift of mine. Is there ambiguity as to whether or not I'm a libertarian?